I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and driving about the things off the beat. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the cause of dying. Yeah, if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country. Just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They don't know milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in the fog of dying key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. And you run it down my country, man, you walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me, and that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And of course, those are European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Just a few minutes ago, news came out that this evening Donald Trump, the President of the United States, has tweeted that he's going to pass an executive order temporarily halting all immigration to the United States. And this may be one of the most important things he's done during his presidency. Absolutely necessary. For one thing, before considering anything else, I believe something in the neighborhood of, I think the figure was 30 million Americans have lost their jobs in the last 2 months. We need to go no further than that. And this is the same argument I make for Canada. So something in the neighborhood of about 3.5 million Canadians are now out of work. 3,200,000 of them in the last 3 weeks. Okay. What is the nature of this argument? Well, with that massive unemployment, how many immigrants do you need? None at all until every capable American who wants a job has a job, or basically, put it a different way, until there's 0% unemployment. And 0% unemployment is actually unemployment of about 2%. That allows for a certain amount of mobility within the job market. But until you've got full employment, You don't need any immigration. Now that is one of the most important points that has or considerations. If you're going to put America first or Canada first, that's one of the most important considerations that has simply been ignored for years. In Canada, the job needs have been decoupled from the immigration intake for many years, at least going back to the Mulroney years from 1984 to 1992. This is absolutely vital. There are other considerations, and I'm going to deal with one of those other considerations. But if, if anybody, and of course already the chattering classes on CNN are, it's part of his long-term aversion to immigration. I hope so. I mean, I really do hope so. Whether it is or not, I don't know. But if we are going to deal with the more pressing problem, and that is the genocide on the installment plan of the European founding settler people of North America. If we're going to do that, we simply have to change stop immigration until such time as we actually have economic need for it, assuming we ever do. But after that, immigration has to be controlled in such a way that it does not continue to upset the ethnic balance. Immigration in both Canada and the United States is now 85% from the third world. Basically, we're immigrating ourselves, the European founding settler people, out of existence. Something has to be done to stop that. Now, one of the things that has been suggested by many quarters for a number of years is a five-year moratorium. Stop it all. Let the country begin to absorb those who are already here and then reconsider. But you really have to stop the intake. And that's the genius of what Donald Trump tweeted out tonight. And I really do hope he follows through. It's one thing to tweet something out, it's another thing to do it. Certainly hope he does it. It's vital on two levels. It's vital short term. Why should the people already made miserable by losing their jobs face further competition from newcomers? They simply should not. Now, of course, it'll be correctly argued that many of those who've lost their job will be quickly rehired back into their jobs. Yes, I don't doubt that that's a likely scenario. However, there has been a serious economic downturn. Some businesses have gone or will go out of business. There'll be no business to rehire the people who have lost their jobs. So it's very important that we start protecting people in advance. And that holds both for Canada and the United States. It's now being actively questioned up there on Twitter whether Justin Trudeau will follow suit. Almost certainly he won't. But that we've got to put the pressure on in that direction. Now, one of the people who was probably the best prime minister we never had was Maxime Bernier, who formed the People's Party of Canada a little over a year ago, ran in the last federal election, ran candidates in almost every riding in the country, did not do as well as one might have hoped. He's a populist. He had a great immigration program and a great free speech program, probably the best in 40 years. Well, he has a regular commentary, and this is his latest. So this is Maxime Bernier, the leader of the Freedom of the People's Party of Canada. Hope it will be Maxime Bernier. There we are.
The Bank of Canada, like many other central banks, has begun a very risky exercise since the start of the crisis. It's been buying the bonds that the federal and provincial governments issue to finance their gigantic deficit. As you can see in this graph, the bank's balance sheet has exploded over the past month from $120 billion to $320 billion. The Bank of Canada pays these government bonds with money it prints, that is, money it creates out of thin air. The bank can print as many as it wants because the dollar is no longer backed by any real asset like gold or silver. So, there are a lot more dollars in circulation and the value of the dollar decreases as a result. And throughout history, many governments have resorted to currency devaluation. It always ends up the same way. Prices increase. The dollars you have in your pocket allow you to buy fewer goods and services. Savings accumulated for your retirement also lose value. You get poorer. In return, governments and all those who have accumulated large debts can pay them off with money that is worth less and at low interest rates. It is an indirect, hidden, and dishonest way of taxing citizens. The current financial system is based on constant debt accumulation and inflation. This system is broken and must be reformed by returning to the gold standard.
Now, this is a fervent and brave message on the part of Maxime Bernier, and I've got to admire his leadership, and I'll be carrying commentaries by him again. Well, congratulations to people in Vancouver yesterday. They staged for the second Sunday in a row a spirited protest calling upon the government to stop the lockdown. And they actually got some publicity. I wouldn't say it was adulatory, but you know, as publicity goes, I suppose it wasn't too bad. And special praise for that goes to the chief organizer, and that was Susan Stanfield. And she is inspired by Operation Gridlock in the United States. I'm going to hopefully put out a report on this. Brian Rue, the videographer, was deeply involved in the protest and videoed it, as he did the one last week. They've had thousands and thousands of hits. They of course, have been, as you might imagine, denounced by the powers that be. Are you really surprised? Let's see. Their slogan was "End the lockdowns." BC Minister of Health Adrian Dix described the protesters as marginal and asked that they be ignored. this is an ongoing problem with politicians, certainly in our country and elsewhere. And that is the absolute arrogance in the way they respond to the people. You know, to say that these protesters were marginal, well, that's a judgment call. That's a judgment call. Because they had about 25 people. If they had 250, would they be marginal? If they had 2,500, would they be marginal? That is really arrogant. And it should not really be the call of a cabinet minister. In a healthy country, the government listens to what the people say and doesn't immediately judge they are marginal. nothing marginal about what represents the feelings of an awful lot of people. I know, I mean, I'm no longer even being nice, to be quite frank, when I'm dealing with these restrictions. You know, have to line up. I mean, the cost of doing business is or I should say the time wasted in doing business is just about doubled. Yeah. Let's see. This morning, this afternoon, I went to the post office. Okay, I didn't have a wait there, but I was only checking my P.O. box. Okay. Then I went to the bank. Well, line up. In fact, you can't even get into the bank. There are about a half dozen of us waiting to get into the bank. We're in a relatively small lobby. With some difficulty, we could keep 6 feet apart. We wait, and we wait, and we wait. They're allowing in two people at a time. There are three tellers, but they allow two people at a time. Why? Who knows? The bank is quite a spacious one. Why could more people not be allowed into the bank? Who knows? It was glacially slow. There were these two negresses. In all the time I was waiting, they were dealing with one teller. I don't know what they were doing. Were they paying down the debt for all of Africa, country by country? Who knows? But anyway, so that probably added... I'd added nearly half an hour to my time. Normally, without these sheep lineups, I would be in and out of that branch, even if there's a bit of a wait, maybe about 5 minutes. So I said to the other people, who in the third world is there as well, I said, this is a sheep line. I mean, this makes no sense. People agreed. We really do have a silenced majority. Not necessarily a silent majority. But a lot of people agree. Let's see, what was the next stop? I had another bank to go to. It was closed, of course, but I wanted to use the bank machine. Even there, I had to wait. Okay, use the bank machine. Let's see, the next stop. Beer store. Okay, beer store. Line up there. That didn't last too long, so I get to the front of the line. I wanted some imported German beer for one of my friends. I asked for the brand by name. Oh, we don't sell it. You have to go to the liquor store. I said, the beer store doesn't have beer. You see, there's no point being nice. I won't go into the intricacies of that. So, okay, fine. Drugstore. Oh, actually, I didn't have to wait too long in the drugstore. That wasn't so bad. Then grocery shopping. Well, I had about a 15-minute wait to get into the market. The same, not very bright rules. That I understand the social distancing. Yeah, I get it. And while it's not a very big supermarket, I think they're basically allowing in maybe four people at a time. So, wait. Everywhere you go. So, as I pointed out to a number of people, this is not a neutral thing, this business of waiting. We, to some extent, are endangered having to spend more time in more places to get the same amount of work, or even a little bit less, done. I think it's absolutely vital to protest. Not to be difficult, not to say, oh, I won't do anything to be socially responsible. No, I'm not going to go and sneeze on people, assuming I had to sneeze. And yeah, look, I'll keep 6 feet away distance. But I want any restrictions to be logical. I want them justified. And no, just because the government says is not enough of a justification for me. Let's use our brains. This is April the 20th. And I would be really remiss if I didn't recognize what the importance of today. This would be the 133rd birthday of Adolf Hitler. He was, if he had lived, he would be 133 years old today. I think that's largely fanciful. Very few, perhaps nobody, but certainly very few people will ever reach that age. But that's not the point. And I think it's right to have a reassessment. And dangerous, of course. He is being presented to us as the greatest demon of all times. And yet there's a strange undercurrent. I think most reasonable people would agree that Stalin and Mao were monsters. Mao killed over 66 million of his own people. Stalin was responsible for the death of at least 20 million Christians in purges and massacres and genocides and so on. In one fell swoop, between 8 and 10 million Ukrainians in 1933, the great Holodomor, or forced starvation, to break the will of the Ukrainian peasants. But point being that these men were truly monsters. Many people know that today. Among the younger generation, I think Mao is largely forgotten. When I was growing up, Mao was a great icon for many of the extreme leftists, a great revolutionary. Now largely forgotten. But the thing is, if I wrote a book and I stuck a picture of Mao Zedong on the cover, large number of people wouldn't even recognize who he was. But it wouldn't exactly attract much attention. Or if I stuck a picture of Stalin, his visage is probably a little bit better known. It has little resonance. Stick a picture of Adolf Hitler there, and you've got instant attention. And I think that despite the insane, relentless propaganda, many people recognize that there was something unusual, something special about Adolf Hitler. And that's what I'd like to reflect on tonight. What might be called the importance and the legacy of Adolf Hitler. Now, what you would normally get if you want to discuss this is just the usual nonsense. The assertion the only thing you know about Adolf Hitler is that he killed 6 million Jews. That's the sum total of the man. Well, he didn't kill 6 million Jews. That's the way he would be dismissed. Well, let's try to take a slightly more mature look at Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933. He ruled National Socialist Germany for 12 years. Hitler took a broken nation, bled white by the unfair reparations imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles, an economy at least as broken as any in the West, ravaged by the Great Depression. 1933, of course, was 3 years into the Depression. And he turned it around in 2 years. That is, I believe, that huge achievement is one of the reasons that even today, 75 years after World War II, after Adolf Hitler's death in a bunker in Berlin, that he is still endlessly vilified. He's vilified as if he were right around the corner. neo-Nazism, the present deputy prime minister, Chrystia Freeland, who from her Ukrainian background and her, I believe it was her uncle who was at least sympathetic to National Socialism. She ought to know better. Whether she does or not, I don't know. But she, in a speech to the United Nations, I guess about 6 months ago, was talking about the dangers to international security. And she ticked off neo-Nazism. Well, what country do Nazis, neo or otherwise, and I actually don't use that term, it's not, that's a pejorative term, National Socialists, but in what country do they rule in the world? Well, none. And the very small National Socialist parties that do exist in other parts of in Europe and elsewhere are, you know, relatively small. So, what is this? Nonsense that they spread. Well, I think there's a very big fear, and part of that fear is summed up in the in what I've just told you about something that isn't very often mentioned, but is undeniable: Hitler's amazing economic recovery program. In fact, in the 1930s, in Canada, for instance, our Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King, in 1937, and I'm paraphrasing, but said something roughly like this. He said, we must study more carefully what Mr. Hitler has done in Germany. They were in awe. But Mackenzie, here Canada was wallowing in the middle of the Great Depression. So was the United States. So was Britain. And yet Hitler turned the economics of an even more broken country all around in 2 years. Well, what was the key to that? I'm not going to give away the whole story, but it was, in my opinion, and there are people who would not agree with me, I'm sure, but basically the practice of a form of social credit, and which was an economic approach to developed by a Scottish engineer named Douglas, C.H. Douglas. And I'm simplifying here a little bit, but in the normal banking system, people... what happens is, you put a deposit, you deposit $100 into a bank account, and you might think, well, the bank then turns around and lends it out at interest. It pays you an infinitesimal little bit of interest. It lends it out at higher interest. That's its spread. None of that comes its expenses and its profit. No, that's not the way it works. It creates credit out of nothing. On the strength of your $1, it will lend out a multiple of about 27. So it'll lend out $2,700 for the $100 you deposit. It'll then lend out $2,700. So $2,600 of that is credit created out of nothing, on which the bank then benefits, because the 26 people it lends the $100 each to, that the $100 it has created out of nothing, then owe the bank not only the principal eventually of the $100, but interest as they go along. Okay, so what C.H. Douglas said in a nutshell was this: the state should use the power to create credit as well. Because often what we're told is there's no money. There's no money, you see. We need to build a hospital. We don't have enough money. Or to get that money, we would have to borrow from the bank or increase taxes or put out issue a bond or something. There is no money. Well, what social credit says is if it is physically and if it's materially possible and humanly possible, it should be made financially possible. So to make a take an example, under Hitler, the German government built this amazing network of roads called the Autobahns, high-speed, well-engineered roads. Now, prior to Hitler's coming to power, the government would say, well, we don't have any money. We don't have enough money to do this. What social credit, or what I believe Hitler did, was he printed the money necessary to accomplish the building. He created the credit. He said, you know, hypothetically, this is going to cost a billion marks. So we have it's physically possible. In other words, we have the raw material, the limestone, the cement, the gravel, the asphalt, and all that stuff. We have the human capability. We have got the engineers, we've got the laborers, and so on. So we've got the raw materials, we've got the human capital. Let's make it happen. So the necessary money was printed into, printed into money. The suppliers of the raw materials were paid, the architects were paid, the workers were paid, and the Autobahns got built. And so it went through German society. Now, that economic system is not exactly what the globalist elite ever wanted. And I think some of the 6 million, or that is now called the Holocaust rhetoric, the Holocaust agenda, which is pounded at us endlessly. Some of that is to distract from what it was Hitler accomplished. And other people might request exactly the same thing. So rather than be able to have an objective study of what Hitler did, from the point of view of his mortal enemies, far better to simply say he was the greatest demon of all times. Nothing good. No, you can't say anything good about him. And the Germans who have, because a female TV newsreader a few years ago who said something that he created an efficient economic system. She didn't say she agreed with him, or she wasn't trying to whitewash his government or say that he didn't commit the crimes that he is alleged to have. She simply said that economically he did some good. But she was fired faster than it took her to put on her lipstick. That's how fanatical the opposition to Adolf Hitler is today, even though, you know, he's been dead for 75 years. So that's one thing. People quite often comment on the internet. They make observations about, well, what would have happened if Hitler had not been defeated in World War II? What would the world look like? Well, you know, of course, that's always a speculative game. The correct cultural Marxist party line would be, well, he would have genocided everybody he possibly could. wiped out the whole world. I laugh because it is so laughable. Not very well known is the fact that Adolf Hitler had many non-white allies. There were Sikh, there were Hindu, there were Black, there were Muslim, Eunice, the fought, that willingly joined the German army and fought with them. See, as an added smear, Adolf Hitler's enemies have said, well, he was this horrible racist. He hated everybody. Well, he hated everybody except blonde, blue-eyed Aryans. The problem with that is that Hitler himself was not blonde. Blue-eyed, yes, but brown hair. This bizarre caricature never held any water. In the famous 1936 Berlin Olympics, Hitler made a special point of praising one of the great American athletes, a Negro, Jesse Owens. In fact, Jesse Owens would say for years that he had been better treated in Berlin by Hitler than he was treated back home in the United States. Kind of interesting. Hitler was not on a mission to exterminate non-whites. What was his goal, were his goals? Well, one was the economic rebuilding of Germany. Good. Another was to reunite the fractured German people, partly through history, but then particularly with the Treaty of Versailles. Large portions of German populations were separated from what was left of Germany. There were a considerable number of Germans in Poland. There were Germans in northern Yugoslavia. There were Germans in other places, in the parts of in the Sudetenland, in what's now Czechoslovakia, what was then Czechoslovakia. His goal was to bring those people, those who wanted to, back into the Greater Germany or the German Reich. A perfectly legitimate goal. And what most threatened Europe? Godless Soviet communism, largely Jewish instigated and Jewish managed. Communism was a lethal enemy of the West, of democracy, of Christianity. And Hitler saw, quite rightly, that he could not achieve his agenda without, at the very least, containing and perhaps actually destroying Soviet communism. Many people in Europe, many intelligent, educated people, saw basically Adolf Hitler as the best chance to stop communism, which threatened the West and desperately threatened Christianity. That's why large numbers of Europeans joined and fought to the bitter end that joined Hitler in the Waffen-SS, because they recognized that he was the last best hope to turn back and to stop communism. So people say, well, of course, it did not work out that way, due to, I think, an unholy alliance between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. The communists won the Second World War. They gained a whole lot of territory. They, of course, took out their mortal enemy, Adolf Hitler. They enslaved Poland, the Baltic countries, Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Yugoslavia, and tightened their grip on places like the Ukraine. In fact, Western Europe was turned over for almost 50 years to communism, to communist slavery. Wow, we won the war! Yeah, we did, didn't we? And on another level, because of the degeneracy of our leadership, countries in the West, Britain at first, then the United States and Canada in 1965, and other European countries like France and others, in the late 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, were welcoming in their replacements. Massive third world immigration. and nationalism and national pride began to crumble. I've asked Englishmen, do you think if you have, quote, lost the war to Hitler, or more likely, arranged a peace, you know, not fought to the bitter end, if that had happened, do you think parts of the north of England, like Bradford and Hull, would now be basically Muslim cities? Do you think the heart of the British Empire, London, would now be a majority non-white city? It's inconceivable. Absolutely inconceivable. What did Hitler offer the British? Hitler didn't want war. He repeatedly emphasized he didn't want war. After the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, was absolutely humiliated on the battlefield and was basically in full retreat to the French port of Dunkirk, 360,000 British troops, hardly any weapons, utterly defenseless. Hitler could have moved in for the kill, and perhaps that was his greatest mistake. Had he captured, taken his prisoners, or killed, but it undoubtedly would have taken most of them as prisoners. If he had captured, basically, that was almost all that was left of the British Army. Could Britain have possibly risen again? Almost certainly not. They would then, at that point, of being absolutely vulnerable to an invasion. An invasion would not be easy, but they would have been vulnerable to it, with almost nothing to fight back with. At that point, almost certainly, they would have had to have accepted a peace. Hitler did not want to destroy Britain. Hitler, in fact, saw some sort of an alliance with Britain. Britain keeps its empire and does its thing in the rest of the world, and Hitler has a free hand on the continent to reunite the German territories and to defeat Soviet Russia. Those were his goals. I remember even as a young person hearing about Hitler, part of his and the propaganda even going on in the 60s and 70s that Hitler wanted to conquer the world. This is nonsense shouldn't be uttered by a retard. What's the evidence? He didn't have the troops really in the end to effectively conquer Russia. If he can't entirely conquer the European continent, how's he going to conquer the world? I mean, this was insane, and that was never his goal. He was never an internationalist. He didn't want to impose national socialism on the world, unlike communism, which saw itself as an internationalist organization, an ideology. Anyway, I'll have some further thoughts on Hitler. And subsequent programs. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. We're kind of on a German theme here, I guess it would be only fitting to have some German music. So I'm going to play exactly that. Now, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Here on White Resistance Radio or AltRightTV.com.
Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Back to the game tomorrow night. Sign out to, as always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on altrighttv.com or whiteresistanceradio.com.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever.